everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, and Tenable's Chief Executive, Ron Gula, will be along later for this week's sponsor interview. And we'll be getting Ron's take on Immunity Inc.'s El Jefe, which is a technology we discussed in last week's show, as well as chatting about process monitoring more generally. That's coming up later. In this week's feature interview, we're catching up with David Litchfield. David is a renowned database hacker and a co-founder of NGS Software, which was actually acquired by NCC Group in 2008 for a gazillion million pounds. David left NGS back in February this year, and he's doing his own thing these days. So, of course, since February, he's spent his time scuba diving, playing nude laser tag with lingerie models, and chilling out on his mega yacht. But he also found time to write a database forensics tool for Oracle databases, and there's an alpha release of that tool happening this week. It's called Verity, and he'll be joining us soon to tell us all about it. But first, as always, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, in our first bunch of news items this week, and it is a bunch of news items, because we're looking down the barrel of a metric arse ton of locals in various Linux distributions.
Yeah, the latest Ubuntu kernel release has something like 27 CVE numbers allocated to it.
Man, like, I couldn't believe it when I clicked on that and just saw CVEs referenced, and there was like, you know, half a page of them.
Yeah, and probably half of those are local privs. The rest are, you know, denial of service, which in the context of kernel bugs has traditionally meant local privilege escalation. Certainly, yeah, the last, you know, 6 months or so, if you've been if you're a hosting provider doing, you know, virtual hosting inside the same shared kernel environment, you know, using either just, you know, kind of Apache virtual hosting or using something like the kernel context patches, then, you know, you're absolutely screwed. Like, you have to patch your boxes weekly, probably, you know, reboot them weekly or case splice them weekly to get all this stuff patched. And that's just the kernel space. Like, we've got a bunch of user land bugs as well. Taviso Ormandy from Google dropped a sweet Linux loader privesque a couple of days ago, which is awesome. I used it yesterday on a job, worked a charm.
Yeah, I can tell you're in a good mood today because you got root yesterday.
Yeah, I did indeed.
So it's not just Adobe, Microsoft, and Oracle. You know, it was kind of nice because it was a holy trinity, an unholy trinity. What's, you know, now we got another one?
The four horsemen of the fail-pocalypse? I don't know.
The four horsemen of the fail-pocalypse. I dig that, man. That's pretty good. Was that off the cuff?
Jeez, That's why you pay me.
Do you do children's parties? Okay, moving on to an Adobe story. Adobe is due to release its new version of Acrobat Reader, Adobe Reader X. That is coming apparently within 30 days, according to CNET. And that will include, you know, it's going to be sandboxed, this one.
Yeah, so this is the big release that's meant to, you know, drop their new sandboxing technology, which is supposed to, in theory, mitigate the impact of the sort of vulnerabilities we've seen in Acrobat Reader over the last, you know, couple of years or so. As to whether that actually happens, you know, I guess it'll remain to be seen. I mean, you have to look at the amount of work and external auditing resource that, say, Google have put into the Chrome sandbox to try and get that robust. And, you know, even then, there's still been issues in the sandboxing technology they use. And they took a pretty radical approach to it. You know, I guess the real proof will be in whether or not, you know, we start seeing a reduction in the number and severity of Acrobat bugs.
Yeah, the Chrome sandbox is interesting because, you know, there's been a few bugs, but not many. I mean, considering it's a new browser, you'd think there's going to be a lot of ugly shit in there that actually is being mitigated by the...
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it's not really new browser in the sense that the rendering engine is WebKit.
Yeah, WebKit, yeah.
And, I mean, the, you know, the actual sandboxing environment itself was new. And, I mean, you have to look at the sort of the work that Ben Hawkes and...
Mark Dowd
did on their native client sandboxing technology. I mean, they've, you know, sunk a lot of time into getting that right. And, you know, I'm not sure that I feel particularly confident that Adobe is better equipped to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't know, though. I mean, that's the problem. And changes, you know, companies can make security a priority, and it still takes years to get stuff to trickle through. We saw that with Microsoft in the Trustworthy, you know, Computing Initiative or whatever the hell. But, yeah, look, it's a step in the right direction. So let's hope that they've put enough thought into the construction of this sandbox and that it actually holds up.
Yep, indeed.
Alrighty. Oh, to the lulls of the week. Kaspersky got ponzerized and they got used to serve up Rogue AV.
Well, is that not just the sweetest thing?
It's pretty sweet.
But no, this is a story that I actually read on the Trend Micro blog.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a her, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Trend Micro making a bit of fun of Kaspersky getting their box owner. Like, it sounded like what, their C panel or something.
Yeah, it's obviously like some sort of C panel thing, you know. And it just shows you though that, like, no matter what happens, there's always something that either you haven't thought of, or, you know, it's probably not going to be your fault, like, or, you know, if it wasn't going to be a cPanel bug, it was going to be them having their domain hijacked or this or that. You know, it just goes to show you that there's always something you haven't thought
of. Yeah, well, I mean, this is the classic asymmetry problem, right? I mean, you got to get absolutely everything right, and the hacker's only got to find the one thing up, and, you know, everyone fucks up.
Yep, and everyone's laughing at Kaspersky right now.
Yeah,
you know,
sucks to be those guys.
But it happens to everyone. I remember when IBM ISS got owned in like 2003. This was funny though, because Kaspersky have owned up and they've said, yeah, you know, we got owned, we fixed it, we've moved on, right? Which is, of course, the appropriate response. But ISS, this is years ago, what was it? 2003. I was working in Sydney for ZDNet, and their internet watch box or something, they provided free downloads of Black Ice to students and stuff from this box, and it got owned. And so I was writing the story, and they came back to me with a statement saying that they deliberately made that box vulnerable so that they could capture Windows rootkits.
Sure, right? Sure, yeah.
And the funniest thing about it was, and they said, oh, well, you know, we had to use a production server because we wanted to attract skilled attackers. That's how far they took this delusion, right? And they even said, and what made that especially funny is that they got popped through dot printer. You remember the IIS dot printer? Someone just forgot to patch it. Oh, God, how we laughed. It was so funny. But, you know, they just kept lying and lying. And I just thought, and I'm like, oh, so what amazing intel did you capture? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, we got some kids, you know, Cybounce password.
Yeah, we got a bloody, we managed to capture an exploit that's, you know, been around for 6 months that they used to own us with. Anyway, so that's the wrong way, Kaspersky the right way. Yeah, just admit it, move on. Agreed?
Agreed, yes.
Yeah, okay. Oh, now, Microsoft has made a bit of a statement here. They say the amount of exploitation of Java at the moment is just through the roof.
Yeah, well, there's been some beautiful Java bugs. I mean, even as far back as, you know, kind of 2006, 2005, there were some really good Java runtime bugs and the sort of thing you could exploit from an applet in a browser. And yeah, I think, you know, it's a fair call to say that these were overlooked to some extent. I mean, you know, I've seen environments, you know, to this day where, you know, exploit from 2006 against the Java runtime still works just fine. Mm. So yeah, I think it's a fair call to say that Java is receiving a bunch of attention lately, as, you know, client-side vulnerabilities are, you know, very much, you know, the sort of the hip now thing to be doing. But yeah, I think, you know, fair call on Microsoft's behalf. And yeah, it's very, very true. Like, people don't patch their Java runtimes and people do get owned, and increasingly so.
But they've got some stats in here. They say the attacks against Java flaws have increased from hundreds of thousands of attacks per quarter to more than 6 million. I don't know how they measure that metric.
Yeah, I mean, you know what we all think about, you know, this kind of stats, right? I mean, anything that was an actual number in it, there's almost certainly bullshit.
Yeah, but Microsoft is probably pulling some... This had come from their report. What is it? The security incident report or whatever the hell. And it actually is comprised of data that they pull from telemetry that they get from Windows. So the Microsoft reports actually do have some pretty good info in them. So I'm guessing that what they're seeing, that means, you know, evidence of exploitation on boxes that are feeding them telemetry. So that would be probably, you know, hundreds of thousands to, you know, 6 million during the third quarter of 2010. So, you know, I think Microsoft are actually a little bit better than a lot of other companies when it comes to metrics.
Yeah, I certainly don't doubt that there has been a relative increase, but yeah, I'm always kind of wary of, you know, absolute numbers, eh?
Mm-mm-mm. All right, now, look, this next piece has become quite topical. This next topic has become quite topical in light of Stuxnet, but the North American Electric Reliability Corps is apparently requiring that members of the bulk power system in the United States implement protections against a vulnerability called Aurora.
Very confusingly.
Confusingly, I know, because of the whole China Google thing. That's according to Secure Computing Magazine, which is carrying this story.
So yeah, they did some experiments back in the mid-late 2000s in which they attempted to determine whether or not you could actually blow up electricity generation equipment, given access to the SCADA control systems. And it seems likely to me that probably you could, but the important thing, I guess, here is some empirical evidence. And they actually went ahead and did it. And
they videoed it, which is awesome.
And they videoed it, yeah.
So, yeah, you can actually make a generator go pop. And they call this the Aurora vulnerability. And, this piece basically says that, they've identified it in 2007. And, they're still trying to get people to mitigate it.
Yeah, well, I guess, taking any kind of SCADA attack seriously is difficult, and having this kind of, having some backup that says, actually, yes, we can blow shit up is useful. But on the other hand, right, we've already seen SCADA attacks that cause real world damage. I mean, by their nature, that's the point of SCADA systems. The one where the guy released the sewage in Queensland.
Yeah, but that wasn't over IP. That was a custom bit of wireless kit. Everyone loves to cite the Marucci Shire incident, but it's not really, it's nothing like a contemporary attack. It was an insider who used custom wireless kit, who was basically an administrator of the system. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't an attack over the internet. It wasn't even IP enabled, from what I can tell. So,
Well, I suppose the point that I'm trying to make is that the whole point of a SCADA system is to have some kind of real world impact. So it's not particularly surprising that
That you can make something go bang.
You can make something go bang with it. Like I would have thought that was fairly much a given. But I guess having a video of it is kind of important.
Yeah, so anyway, this NERC group in the US is, sort of starting to crack the whip. And, this comes after two years ago, there was a statement from a US politician, Jim Langevin. He's quoted in this story as saying, "I think we could search far and wide and not find a more disorganized, ineffective response to an issue of national security."
Which is saying a lot, given how many disorganized and ineffective responses that we see in this industry.
Now, here's a story that we covered some time ago, and we were really, we planned to keep an eye on it, and some more news has broken. This has been covered by Kim Zetter at the Wired Threat Level blog. A federal judge in New Jersey has ruled that those guys who were scalping tickets using an automated capture bypass. And I think there were some civil proceedings and whatever. There's now going to be a criminal trial, which is going to basically charge these guys with a criminal offense for busting capture.
Which, this seems a little crazy to me. I mean, their defense lawyers argued that, this basically amounts to, contract breach, civil contract breach with the...
Yeah, it's a violation of terms of service, basically.
Yeah, exactly, with the actual people selling the tickets in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me fair enough, right? They're obviously, being a bit fraudulent in that respect. But to actually call bypassing captures with, automated technology a criminal offense, it does seem a little bit of a stretch to me.
Well, they're using bots, for one. Right,
okay. And there are certainly some criminal aspects to it. Like the story alleges that they actually broke in and stole source code from some of the ticket-selling people to try and understand their capture generation systems, which is, I guess is,
I think the key thing here is prosecutors have alleged that bypassing capture is unauthorized access. So, it's going to be really interesting to see how that one flies when it actually goes to trial, if it goes to trial.
Yeah, because that kind of logically says that bypassing the terms and conditions of a website is also, criminal access.
I don't know about that. I mean, we can't just say, we're not lawyers.
That's kind of the implication, right? That's where it's heading.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think that this is a pretty specific case. I think people tend to make pretty sweeping generalizations when things like this happen, but this seems to be a pretty specific case where over a period of sort of like 8 years or whatever, these guys were using bots, they were bypassing capture, they bought like 1 million tickets and then sold them at a markup. They made something like $25 million. This isn't someone just who happens to be fooling around and accidentally bypasses the terms and conditions of a website. This seems like a fairly dishonest enterprise.
Yeah, it certainly is a very large-scale kind of mechanized operation that is not in doubt.
But there's the update for you anyway. I mean, we've been following this one on the Wired blog, so, it's we just thought we'd give you all an update.
Yeah, well, I guess, we'll just have to see how that one ends.
Now, dude, it's like so 10 years ago right now. there's been a lot of hoo-ha over the last few days about IDS evasion, and it's kind of... It's a bit like, there's a great story I pulled here from Threat Post, written by Paul Roberts, which is just, the headline is great. Warning about IDS evasion greeted by chorus of meh.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, this company Stonesoft, who I believe they make some kind of IDS product themselves, claim to have come up with a bunch of ways for essentially canonicalization bugs, where the IP reassembly process of your IDS doesn't match the way that your host operating systems involved in the connection treat the TCP session or the IP sessions that are going on, which, this is not at all new or exciting. They've got a number of specific techniques, apparently, some of which are relatively novel. But really, IDS evasion, not really a surprise here.
You mean you can evade IDS using things like packet fragmentation?
I know, I'm shocked.
Oh, stunning. Yeah. It's still cool to see, people even now turning up some slightly new techniques of ways to mess around with IPv4, though. You've got to admit that.
Yeah. You know, I'm not suggesting in any way that their research is not interesting or in some cases probably quite advanced in the field that they're studying. It's just calling this a major change in the threat model, the state of the IDS, the effectiveness of IDS in general. I think it's probably overstating it a bit.
Yeah. So we can pull back from DEFCON 1.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, let's face it, your IDS as it is isn't going to detect any intrusions anyway. So, I mean, a few more obfuscation and evasion techniques, really, the chances are still zero.
So what, this basically tells us that your fail kit might fail. Anyway, well, on that slightly depressing note about the effectiveness of IDS and IPS technology, I think we're gonna actually wrap up the news segment, Adam. Thank you very much for joining us, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Pat. I look forward to seeing you at RuxCon.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Up next, it's time for our feature interview with David Litchfield. David is best known as a database hacker who has probably caused more damage to Oracle's image than anyone else on the planet over the years. Well, at least in the eyes of security professionals. His talent for finding ODAY in Oracle's products is a little bit on the freaky side. It's like his party trick, find me an ODAY, and he just goes, bam, there you go. Funnily enough, the company's most recent update contained fixes for bugs Litchfield reported to Oracle's security team around 2 years ago. So I guess they're a bit backed up, but, they're still working on stuff he submitted to them years ago. David founded NGS Software. He co-founded NGS Software, a company that was acquired in 2008 by NCC Group. Interestingly enough, NCC Group just acquired ISEC Partners recently as well. And earlier this year, David left NGS to pursue his own interests. He's had a bit of a break, but all of the while, he's been working on his pet project, Verity, and that's spelled V3RITY. If you Google it, you will find it. Verity is David's new company, and at this stage, it just consists of him working funny hours building database forensics software that he plans to release for free. In fact, an alpha release of his first product, a forensics investigation tool for Oracle databases, is actually due out today. So I got David on the line to ask him why he decided to begin work on Verity in the first place.
I've spent all my life, well, not all my life, but a large part of my life, looking for vulnerabilities in the hope that eventually they'll all get fixed. But at the bottom, at the end of it, there's always another ODAY out there. So I came to the conclusion that if someone's going to break in at some point, the next best thing we can do is try and find out how they broke in, what they did when they got there, and, what we can do to stop the same thing from happening again in the future. And that means forensics and breach investigations,
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned finding Oracle bugs because, you're quite well known for having found an absolute ton of them.
Yep.
Did it surprise you when they released their recent update and you were credited in the advisory?
No, I don't think I was surprised because I think, when I retired from NGS Software, I think I had about 30 or so, maybe a wee bit more outstanding issues with them. And
because we're talking about stuff that you reported to them like 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, exactly. They'll be fixing them for a wee while to come, probably, So
yeah,
about time I started stocking up on some more, actually. Joking.
Yeah. Well, you got to keep a steady stream of them going out there if you're going to make cash in on this whole forensics boom. So,
well, to be fair, the whole forensics thing is, as I said, I've given up on that whole research side of things because at the end of the day, there is always going to be another bug in Oracle. So, as I said, the next best thing we can do is try and find out, if someone's compromised the system, how did they do it? How did they get in and so on? and what they did when they got there, and who did it, if potentially leading to an arrest and so on, you know. So
now, I imagine as part of your research in working on Oracle Forensics and indeed creating a product, you would have yep. studied quite closely the modus operandi of the database hacker. So what does a typical attack look like? Are there certain techniques that are particularly common or popular when it comes to messing with Oracle DBs?
Yeah, absolutely. PLSQL injection is clearly, you know, one of the more common and easiest methods to exploit. And what that essentially is, within the Oracle database server itself, there's some custom packages, built-in packages that are made from PLSQL, which is like the programmable version of SQL within Oracle. They're similar to TSQL in SQL Server. And there are a large number of default extant packages, and some of these have vulnerabilities in them. And part of the security architecture of Oracle is that whoever defines a procedure, when it executes with their privileges, basically. So if the sys, in other words, you know, God on the database, if he or she defines a procedure and it's vulnerable and someone can execute that procedure or package or whatever it happens to be, then the code will execute with sys privileges, very much like a set UID vulnerability on, Unix, kind of.
So why isn't this something? Is this something that Oracle could be working around?
Well, they've made great strides, actually, in protecting against it. They've got some data flow analysis tools that says, you know, user input goes through here, 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 and here, and so on. And they're doing a lot of work in terms of, you know, trying to close as many of these holes as they possibly can. And so whereas in early versions of, say, 10G, it was, you know, so easy to find a PLSQL injection flaw, it's a lot harder in later versions like Oracle 11G. It's so much more superior to like earlier versions.
Wow, it sounds like you're actually giving Oracle an attaboy, which is a bit strange.
Well, it could be confused for that, but they've definitely still got a length of ways to go.
Yeah,
I think there's still a lot of vulnerabilities lying around the boundaries. So like from when they switched to from PLSQL to, say, Java, or PLSQL to like underlying C libraries, I think there's a, you know, in those transitional phases, I think there's probably still a hell of a lot of flaws to be found, you know?
Now, David, you've been seen as a pretty fierce critic of Oracle over the years, having found a large number of vulnerabilities in their products and also been quite, yeah, as I said, quite vocal about what you see as their deficiencies in securing their products. Do you think that they have got better? Do you think that they have made some improvements, or are they still the same old big bad Oracle that we know and love?
I think they've definitely made great improvements on their security processes, definitely, and that can't be denied. But as you brought up earlier, you know, nearly 2 years after me last doing research on Oracle security vulnerabilities, they're still patching things, you know? So it would have been nice to have seen an improvement in the speed of their security response and so on. I don't know. I last time I gave a speech on Oracle security was at Black Hat Federal last year, and I gave them a B- for security effort. So I'll probably still say that's, you know, where they are. So still a pass, but not quite an A+.
Where were they 5 years ago, would you say?
Oh, they flunked out of university in the first term, basically. They were kicked out.
they were wearing a dunce's hat in the corner?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, a dunce's hat in the corner, that's probably
if
the
they
best
were
way.
Still allowed in the building.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I don't know if you saw it, but the Verizon Business, you know, they do an annual data breach investigation report. And what I found interesting about that is that, you know, most of the stolen data that came out of databases came from credential theft. You know,
yep.
How from a forensics point of view, I mean, is it really easy to spot credential? I mean, I suppose it would be because it's going to be someone logging in and just taking an absolute crap load of data out. But, you know, if someone's a little bit sneaky with some stolen credentials, how are you going to spot that?
Well, it's definitely one of the harder things to spot. If someone does something to the database server in terms of, like, you know, inserts a new record or edits and updates a new record or deletes something, that's really, really easy to spot, you know, because obviously that goes into the transaction logs. But if someone's only reading data, in other words, selecting data from the database server, that's so much more difficult to spot. But there is still evidence that can be found. So there's a couple of tables that basically exist to help Oracle improve management of resources, like how much memory to allocate for certain queries and stuff like that. So one of them is the call usage table, and that says what tables have been selected from using what kind of predicates. In other words, you know, the where clause and so on in a SQL statement. Now, if we know, let's say, our applications in our environment, you know, select from specific tables using specific where predicates, that would exist in the call usage table. Now, if suddenly things start appearing in the call usage table that don't match our applications, let's say someone does a SQL injection attack and does a select, you know, credit cards, select credit cards from credit cards table where is valid equals true kind of, that kind of predicate, if it's not in our applications, would suddenly start appearing in this call usage table. So we can infer from that that someone's making queries that outside what our applications do. And there's a couple of other things, like if you're exfiltrating data using, say, UTL HTTP to slide data out by the network over a web request, basically, or even UTL Inidra, making DNS queries and embedding data within there. If we own the web server or the DNS server, we can actually, you know, gain data. We can exfiltrate data across the network. Now, these kind of attacks are, you know, because there's a network round trip, that will be logged in certain tables for the automatic workload repository because they take a long time to execute, you see. So that select query will exist there. In other cases, there's these virtual views like v.sql or v.dbcache, object cache. And what these have is information about what has been recently accessed. Like in v.sql, you've got about 2 to 5,000 SQL queries. So there might be evidence of a select in there, someone stealing, you know, PII from there, from the database, might be in this v.sql. If there's, you know, objects have been accessed that one wouldn't normally access in, say, our applications, again, if that's in the DB object cache, then that's, again, we can infer from that that someone's been, you know, selecting things that they shouldn't necessarily be selecting. So even though normally one wouldn't think we can't, if auditing's not enabled, we can't get, you know, we can't work out who's been stealing what data, we still can, you know, just by knowing this system inside and out and analyzing and saying, where could we possibly find evidence? And that's why Verity, the product, is going to be such a great product, because I've, you know, not meaning to blow my own trumpet or anything, but I've got a lot of experience in understanding Oracle attacks and so on. So I can plow that into the forensics tool and say, this is where we need to be looking for evidence and so on.
Mate, I don't think you'd find anyone in this industry who would argue that you don't have probably more experience messing with Oracle than anyone else. You know, what I find interesting, though, is that you've identified, you know, these clear sort of smoking gun style queries and things, and you know how to pull them out of these, you know, wacky, bizarro temporary log files and stuff. Why is it that you didn't think that this could be a cool, you know, database security product? So instead of, you know, instead of just catching it after the fact, you know, you could say all of those things that identified those that suspicious activity, you could sort of spot it in real time and, you know, maybe send someone an SMS.
Absolutely. When I get the forensics product done, there's a number of other products which I'm planning, basically.
Oh, okay, so, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because I really wondered about that, because I thought, geez, this sounds like, you know, Dave's figured out how to build a really good intrusion detection system for a database.
To be fair, I think there's probably a lot of products out there that, you know, would do that kind of thing. There's definitely, you know, database firewalls and, like, audit systems out there that would probably do that. I don't know to the extent to which they do it, but it's something they could probably easily add to themselves, you know?
Well, I find it curious, you know, we had a chat before the interview about how, you know, we're spending so much money on antivirus firewalls and IDS when something like, you know, 50 to 70% of our records, whatever it is, it's a massive percentage, you know, a huge proportion of our stolen records of personal and financial information come from databases. And what are we spending on database security?
Well, I think personally, people should be spending a lot more, but the products are definitely out there. It's just whether people are employing them or not, you know. There's a great range of, say, VA scanners that, you know, tell you if your systems are vulnerable, like obviously NGS's product, NGS Squirrel. I'm no longer with them, of course, so it's not like I'm plugging their product for...
Yeah, no. Hey, I've invited you on so you can plug your own product, mate. So if you want to plug your previous employer's product, that's fine.
You know, and then there's like database encryption products out there, and encrypting data is obviously a good step forward. you know, if someone manages to compromise it without the encryption keys, that, you know, it's of little value to them. Then, of course, there's, you know, audit systems out there, there's database firewalls. So these products are out there. It's just whether people are deploying them. And if they are deploying them, are they deploying them properly? Clearly, I've, you know, for the past, what, 7 years of my life, I've been working in database security assessments. And certainly to begin with, there wasn't very many people deploying these kind of products. And if they were deploying them, they weren't, you know, deployed properly, you know, so.
So, yeah, it's still a lot of work to do, huh?
Yeah.
So tell us about this company of yours, Verity. Is it a services company that is also in creating products sort of very similar to NGS in that way?
Well, not really. Right now, its sole focus is developing, you know, this database forensics tool because, as I said, there isn't, you know, a breach investigation tool designed specifically for investigating breach database servers. So Verity is going to be that product, basically, and I'm going to be releasing the alpha version of it tomorrow, quickly followed up by the beta version, and then hopefully the full version, you know, sometime probably early December. And the product's free, so if people want to go ahead and download it and use it in their investigations, by all means, go ahead and do so. That's why it's there, you know. So
how do you plan to make money out of the thing?
Right now, I don't intend to. I'm, you know, comfortable, you know, having sold NGS, and I'm enjoying doing this as a self-chosen project and everything like that. So right now, it's not about making money. It's about delivering a really cool, exciting product, you know, so.
Yeah, yeah, it's about doing something fun, which for you is writing a Oracle database forensics tool.
I'm going to be offering training off the back of it as well at places like Black Hat. So in January at Black Hat Federal, I'm going to be doing a training course on the product because obviously you can make the product, but if people don't know how to use it, and I think that's where one of the problem lies. It's sort of bridges the gap between a database administrator and a breach investigator / you know, incident responder. The incident responders might not necessarily know about, you know, databases, and so really if they're going to be doing an investigation on a breach database server, they're going to need to understand more about database servers. So that's where training would come in useful. And again, database administrators might not know necessarily about the security side of things or the breach investigation side of things. So that's where, again, you know, training would come in useful. So,
well, David Litchfield, thank you very much for joining us on the show to bring us up to date with your latest project. And we wish you all the best with it.
Thanks. No worries.
David Litchfield on the line there with a chat about his new tool, Verity, which should be available as an alpha release right now. But if not, I'm sure in the next couple of days. You can find it by Googling for V3RITY. Shouldn't have any trouble finding it. Next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Ron Gula of Tenable Network Security. Ron is the chief executive of the company, but that doesn't mean he's some private jet-flying cap-tooth freakazoid with a sales background. He's actually a rigid-edge, 100% bona fide security dude. You know, background at the NSA, and, you know, he founded Network Security Wizards back in the day. He's been around for long enough to really have banked some respect. And he's joining us now to talk about process monitoring as a worthwhile activity in security. Last week, we interviewed Justin Seitz from Immunity Inc. about their new product, El Jefe, a pretty simple little agent that logs process activity into a SQL database. You know, what process ran when, what started it, what was the username, what were the arguments, that sort of thing. Actually turns out to be pretty handy information to have. Well, Ron likes the idea of El Jefe and process monitoring more generally. And in fact, he says many companies may indeed have software already deployed with that capability. Some AV solutions have basic process monitoring capabilities. Not as sophisticated as Immunity's tool, but he says this is the sort of stuff you should turn on. Ron joined me by phone yesterday, and here's what he had to say.
Doing process analysis to program execution is just something a lot of people forget. And it's probably the first thing they should be asking for in an incident response. You know, when the airplane crashes, everybody goes to that black box. I want to know exactly what happened going on that plane before it crashed. But with forensics, you know, pretty much you're left with files, traces, you know, maybe some logs, right? But if you have process execution, if you have a list of every program that was executed, you can really do a blow-by-blow sort of replay of what happened. And that's just from a forensics point of view. So I'm hoping that people realize that a lot of SIMs out there, a lot of open source tools, you know, have got this sort of functionality in it. And there's varying levels. So El Jefe is a hook into the kernel to get a little bit more detail. But everybody who's got Windows Professional has got the ability to turn on process execution and get them dumped, you know, to Splunk, to our log correlation engine, to whatever they want to do. And if people have not been looking at process stuff, it's really, really rich. There's a whole bunch of things you can do with it on the trending side, looking for anomalies, looking for just, you know, finding software enumeration. There's a lot of ways to approach that. And I've seen a lot of people happily stare at packet dumps from, you know, network traces and not give a damn about, you know, a list of programs that are executing on a host. And I think that's the wrong attitude for people who are responsible for security.
I get the impression that this is just one of those really simple ideas that, you know, people have either forgotten about or just haven't thought about. And when I compare, I mean, I've sat in front of an IDS console before. I've looked at, you know, just the amount of information you have to sift through. And quite often it can be a little bit difficult to tell really what you're looking at, right? Even after it's been filtered and put through a console. So this just seems like a something that we should all be doing. And as you said, I mean, I hadn't even thought of the, I was thinking of it as a detection thing, but as a forensics tool, you're right. It would be invaluable to have that sort of information.
Absolutely. So as a packet person and a former penetration tester, When I do a lot of public speaking, I basically say you should conclude from being a packet monkey and a pen tester, I don't trust system administrators. And after doing Tenable for the last eight so years, I couldn't be more wrong. There's another side of the story. There's a lot of attacks that get by intrusion detection systems. There's a lot of attacks that get by any virus. Everybody knows that. But they don't know what's state of the art when it comes to just tracking users, right? You know, answering simple questions like, what did Joe run today? What kind of programs was Joe executing for the last couple of days? Or, you know, even more interesting things like, why is TCP dump being run at 1 a.m. on a web server? You know, things like that. And, you know, if you have a SIM, if you have some sort of sense of looking for these things, whether it's an anomaly or rules-based system, it's going to give you a lot more idea of what's going on. And there's a parallel here with system hardening, right? If you have applications on a system that aren't supposed to be there, that's a configuration management problem. That goes right back into auditing, like what we do with tests and so on. But if you don't have a robust configuration, you know, management program, when you're not reducing the amount of programs that are installed on a server, for example, you can at least sit back and say, do I have software running that shouldn't be there? So there's so many ways you can leverage this kind of information. It's a really good deal.
And there's some little things that just make eminent sense, like when, you know, when a username changes on a process, you might want to find out why.
Right, right.
You know, because, I mean, that's just sticks out like the dog's proverbials that it's PrivEsque, right?
Right. And, you know, just like a network intrusion detection system, it's not a holy grail. You know, if you knock over a process with Metasploit, for example, and you're hopping threads, you're going from a process, there's not a lot of new programs that are getting spun off. So it's not like you're going to get an audit trail of that.
No. And they use DLL injection for that as well. So you're not going to pick it because it's part of that process.
And Metasploit might be one example. Who knows? There might be a worm tomorrow that can knock over a certain service, or maybe you can hop from Chrome into the kernel. I mean, there's, you know, if you can think of it, it'll happen these days. But my point is, if you're not even looking, that's doing like the same argument of saying, well, there's packet fragmentation, there's bypass techniques for network intrusion detection. So it's completely worthless to look at network traces. And of course, that's not a good argument. Oh, it's very complimentary. I mean, you know, on the network side, you've got traces of things that might not have any logging or processes, right? So that process that's hopping around undetected, it still has to communicate. It has to put something on the wire. And, you know, some people pride themselves on writing, you know, backdoors that can't be detected by an IDS. But at the end of the day, if you're putting packets on the wire, there's probably going to be some level of activity that can be monitored there. At the same time, as a host, you might have processes running, even daemons running, listening on certain ports, that don't show up because they're encrypted, or just doing silly things like, you know, doing gzip, you know, compression on HTTP, you know, in information, and just compressing the responses, which can be very difficult for a system like a network IDS to put back together.
Yeah, what I like about this is it doesn't just look for suspicious activity on the host, but it allows you to see, you know, from a higher level, when there's been, you know, maybe some sort of coordinated activity across hosts, you can look for an outbreak, things like that. Config, something like Config or Stuxnet, stuff like that is going to really stick out like, you know, like nobody's business. I'm curious though, you guys make a SIM console, you know, will you support the LHFA agents, do you think, or take data from that, or really you just think this is going to be an increasingly popular approach that, you know, many vendors will jump into?
So first of all, he's jumping to a SQL database. It's a new thing. It's pretty cool. There's a lot of ideas. I'd like to see a syslog come out of it, but yeah, if we can support it, we will. At the same time, though, there's different levels of things that people already probably have in their environment. So if they've got a SIM deployed, for example, our log correlation engine grabs Unix process accounting and also Windows process execution AutoTrail. Now, that type of logging is pretty much user, process, and parent ID. Whereas the LHFA goes a step further, right? You're hooking the kernel, you're getting arguments from the command line, you're getting a little bit more information, actually you're getting a lot more information, and that's kind of a good thing. But my point is, if you're a large enterprise and you've got, you know, McAfee, EPO running, you've got different things like that out there, you might have this capability already and not realize it. So I would definitely look at what you have first before you go installing yet another agent or things out there. Now, if it makes sense to use your SIM, to use LHFA, by all means, please do and gather that kind of information. But then you really have to ask yourself, what are you going to do with all this process logging? Is it going to be purely for forensics? Are you going to use it for PCI auditing so you can only prove that certain users ran certain commands?
Well, Ron, that actually leads me to my next question, which is the one drawback that I've seen with this thing is it's another console, right? It's not even, you know, people are saying, oh, the rollout is a big pain in the ass. I don't think so. I think if you pilot this with maybe 2,000 of your users, right, you have a look at the console, you see what sort of quality of information, it could turn out to be a time saver. It could turn out to be something quite worthwhile. The problem, as I see it, is that it's going to require resources. It's going to require, or in a large enterprise at least, it's not like the IDS guys or the AV guys are going to put their hands up and say, yeah, we want to run this. Do you know what I mean? So as a standalone product, I see that it could be a little bit problematic getting off the ground, but if it was integrated into say, an AV solution or something like that, that's when we might see this approach getting more traction.
And the thing is there's really two issues, right? So one, you have to put this agent or kernel hook or whatever you want to call it out to all your systems. That's a configuration management problem. That's different than analyzing the data. Once you have that data, what are you going to do with it? So at Tenable, we really do a few things, and these are things I'd like to see industry standards, right? We alert the first time we see a program run. So, for example, if you run TCP dump all the time on a host, the first time you run it, we're going to kick out an alert that says, hey, TCP dump ran on this host. And you might not think that that's very useful, but the first time you see that alert trip when you have it running on your web server or something like that, it's really an eye-opening thing. And if you can stand back and say, look, we're gathering logs from 10,000 hosts, and here's the 22 programs that ran for the first time today, whether it's Chrome, whether it's some process you've never heard of, very, very valuable.
Yeah, you see TFTP running on your web server, you want to know why, don't you?
Absolutely.
Or, you know, or TCP dump or whatever.
Right. And there's all sorts of attacks against these things, right? People can rename the software. People can, attack the log. Maybe you can invoke things in such a way that the kernel doesn't log it. I mean, that's not the point. The point is you're just profiling the host and seeing what's running, right? So the second thing we can do, and again, I think a lot of people should do this, is they alert based on anomaly. So it's not the fact that TCP dump ran. It's the fact that somebody ran TCP dump 100 times. And guess what? The day before, they didn't run it 100 times. So 100 is an anomaly. And doing those two things together, first time seen and statistical anomaly, that's actually fairly useful. There's a lot of things that fall out of that. For example, every time you open up a new tab in Chrome, you get a new Chrome process. That means you're going to get a different footprint with Chrome.exe than you would perhaps with, you know, Internet Explorer. But the point is, once you have all that data, you got to ask yourself, okay, why am I going to care about this? And I've seen this happen with a couple different of our organizations that use our product. First of all, a lot of them don't understand the periodicity or how often things repeat themselves, right? What's the natural environment? What happens during the week when all my users come in? What do my servers do? What do my databases do? And just being able to put that on a graph, you know, and say, I'm going to trend every time the Oracle, Java, Perl script, you know, update is of tremendous value. At the second time, when things change, if you're graphing these things out, you can really see them. I mean, if you're graphing the number of times the, you know, the top command or the PS command, you know, runs at a certain time, you know, if you can just put that out on a 24-hour plot or a 7-day plot and be able to graph that kind of stuff out, there's a tremendous amount of understanding of what can go on with your network. So there's a lot of value in this sort of thing.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're supporting the renewed buzz around this type of approach.
Yeah, you know, what's old is new, which is a big theme in security. I mean, when I was working at Fort Meade, everything was about process accounting. Everybody wanted to grab the process accounting log. You know, host-based intrusion detection was all about pairing, you know, process, child process privileges, seeing if, you know, someone's able to jump to, you know, UID 0 and all that kind of stuff. So what's old is new again, as usual, in security.
Yeah, no, it is, isn't it? Because it is much more of your Unix-style auditing from the 80s almost.
It's like the Wizard of Oz, man. People have had this stuff built into Windows for a long time. They just haven't been looking at and taking advantage of those logs.
All righty. Well, Ron, that's all we're going to have time for, mate. But thank you very much, as always, for joining the show.
Thanks again. Keep up the excellent work.
Ron Gula on the line there from Tenable Network Security. And thanks again to Tenable for sponsoring the show. I think Tenable's sponsored Risky Business now for something like 3.5 years. And we greatly appreciate their support. Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.